What is peace brain? Peace brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Welcome to the Peace Brain Show. I'm glad that you all have tuned in today. This is Dr. Gail Lash, your host, and today we have a very exciting, a very introspective and wonderful topic, talking about humanity and our belief in separateness when we're really one, and we'll talk more about that in just a minute. I have a quote. Well, obviously I start the show with a quote, but do stay tuned to the end because there's a beautiful Peace Brain meditation at the very end of the show, which I encourage you to participate in and get your Peace Brain energy for the day. So, as always, I open the show with a quote, and this one is a really wonderful one. You probably have heard it. It's from Chief Seattle, and he says, "Humankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. All things are bound together. All things connect." So I love this quote because it does paint the tapestry of life. It paints this woven thread that all of us are part of this wonderful life, this wonderful Earth and all of her inhabitants on it, all of the peoples of the world, and we are but one thread in this web of life. And when I choose to do something, then it affects all those around me, and it affects the entire web, actually, of life. So it's incumbent upon ourselves to remember that whenever we do something with our thoughts, or our actions, or our words, that we are bound together, and we are doing this not only for ourselves, but we're doing it to everyone and for everyone else. So your actions count, your actions matter, and it is a wonderful thing to take a breath and realize we are all connected. So do that for a moment. I'm sure we'll bring that into the Peace Brain meditation at the end as well, but start to reflect how you are connected within your family, your community, your workplace, who you meet, who's around you, and know that you are but a thread walking and weaving your life through the lives of others. Pretty cool. So this is what the topic is today, is really talking about the illusion we have of us versus them, and the essential oneness of humanity. And I have a wonderful guest today, Bart Scholl, who is going to be talking about this oneness of humanity and the illusion that we walk around in, that we are separate from everything else, and how we can actually start to think about, wow, I am connected to that person. I am connected to this issue. I am connected to this part of my earth, or to the entire earth, actually. So Bart is a dear friend, and I want to read you his bio. He's been a dear friend for many years, and he's a very learned scholar. So his bio reads as this: Bart Scholl is a freelance writer and editor who made Atlanta his home for much of his adult life. During that time, he worked primarily in the publishing field and then at an international cable news network based in Atlanta. He is a former member of the Regional Baha'i Council of the Southeastern United States. This elected body works to guide and encourage grassroots community building activities. Its primary focus is to provide spiritual education and community service training to children, youth, and adults so that together they may work to transform their families and their neighborhoods. Bart became a member of the Baha'i Faith as a youth and says it has guided him throughout his life, and its teachings, which balance spirituality with scientific, with its teachings, which balance spirituality and scientific reason. He and his wife, Dilsey, have recently moved to Durham, North Carolina, and are awaiting the birth of their first child, which is so exciting. So, Bart, welcome to the Peace Brain Show.
Thank you, Gail. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on. So this essential topic of that goes so perfectly with this Chief Seattle quote of the illusion of us versus them and that we really are one humanity. How do you think this illusion really started? What was its origin?
Yes, well, thanks again, Gail, and thank you for your important work. Well, as I mentioned before, I truly, in my heart of hearts, I believe that there is no separation from spiritual truth and scientific truth. And in fact, it has been said that science without spirituality or religion is materialism, and religion or spirituality without science is actually superstition. And so I do, in the course of my studies, I have come to conclude, as have much of the world and essentially all of the scientific community, come to believe that humanity certainly has evolved throughout the millions of years on Earth. And so when we look at many aspects of human development, I think it is instructive to go back at times and to ask oneself, what were the things that humanity needed in those earlier years, those hunter-gatherer years before we became agrarian and sat down roots, literally and figuratively? What were those things that guaranteed or that were critical for our survival? And obviously, as a nomadic group of people, it was important to know who the us was and who the them was. And by that, I mean it would be important to be able to notice anything that's out of place or anything that might cause danger to the individual or to the tribe. And therefore, it was at a certain stage of our collective evolution, the idea of an us or them did provide a necessary tool for the carrying forward of that very primitive society.
Exactly, course, that makes sense.
Yes, and then of course, though, it becomes clear now that the age we live in, that those types of things do not serve us quite as well, although I think that it is quite clear that there are reminiscent aspects of that perspective still at play very much in the 21st century that we live in.
So where are we going with all of this today? As you mentioned, we don't really need the hunt. We're not a hunter-gatherer by and large. We can, we're more of a collective society rather than our tribe or our clan or our city. We've become a global society, even though we obviously are very wedded to still our nation's states. So where is humanity right now on this evolutionary scale you just painted?
Yes, that is the question, isn't it? Well, where is humanity and where are we? The answer to that varies depending upon who one might ask. There are some that say we are about ready to go down. There are some that believe that we are reaching the end of civilization. There are all types of perspectives of where we are. But I believe from my study of history and my study and reflection in the Baha'i teachings, I've come to believe that we are at a very exciting time in our collective evolution as human beings. Far, far, far from being near the end of anything, we are in many ways at the beginning. And I have come to conclude that where we are actually is in our adolescence. And it's interesting to think of the aspects of adolescence within a human being. I think that there are many things that we can learn when we examine the micro of anything and then attempt to apply that to the macro. For instance, in an individual human being, adolescent person, we have a certain set of characteristics. They have, on the one hand, they have achieved in many ways the height of their physical prowess. They will never be more physically strong or faster. Their hearing will never pick up on the high decibels that they can hear at that age than as they get older. So from a physical standpoint, they have reached their peak in many ways. However, from an emotional standpoint and perhaps a spiritual standpoint, they are just beginning. And particularly from an emotional standpoint, they are still essentially children in many ways. Very self-centered, very egotistical, just due to their normal psychological development. In fact, there are now studies out which, especially as we look at the application of law and crime and punishment, there are studies out now suggesting that the human brain, there are certain things that have just not fully baked until after 25. And so there is an impetuosity within the human adolescent. And I think that those things can be very clearly identified within humanity itself. For instance, in an individual human being, they are only thinking about themselves. They are not necessarily thinking about even maybe their family or, and certainly not their community beyond. Of course, there are amazing youth doing many altruistic things, and that's another story, but for the sake of the argument. So we find ourselves living in a world now where we, due to technology and the advance of technology, it has certainly, as has been said by so many people, has really collapsed the world into a single community.
So you're saying that because we started out, obviously, as these tribes and these separate states, and as we grew into cities and towns and nations, we started to grow our collective, in other words. And now with technology, obviously the internet and these radio shows, et cetera, you know, you have the way of reaching the entire world. So now we're being called to go from that individualistic adolescent state of looking out for me to a more global collective community worldview. And that step is the challenge that we're having?
It is the challenge, Gail, yes. But it's actually, in a way, it's not a new challenge, because as one dispassionately looks at the social evolution of humanity and its gradual but checkered advancement of civilization, we'll see that there's been a number of many breakthroughs. From that early time that I referenced to, when we were hunter-gatherers, there was the concept and the identification of family. And then, of course, that grew to the identification and embracing of tribe, and from tribe to city, and from city to nation, and now from nation to the world. And so we find ourselves now with this new challenge of beginning to recognize that we are truly, as Baha'u'llah says, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, the earth is one country and mankind its citizens. Now, it's interesting to look at this because we live in a very polarized time right now, and certainly partisan politics plays a very significant role in that polarization. Partisan politics, which is, I believe, divisive in nature as opposed to serving the citizenry. But it's interesting to, once again, instructive to look at the micro and apply that to the macro. So, for instance, let's go back to the time of this country, the United States, and the founding of the forging together of these 13 colonies into what then became the United States. Very interesting to dispassionately examine the paradigms that were at place there, and the positions that individual people and individual groups were holding tenaciously to. At such a time, these boundaries between colonies were certainly more pronounced. There were different currencies in these colonies. There were different police forces, if you will, ways of maintaining order. There were import tariffs between colony to colony. In fact, it's been said that in some cases, for instance, it was more expensive to import corn between colonies than to import corn from Britain. And so we had this concept of statehood that was being so valued as the proper way and best way to organize human affairs, that it was very difficult to think of giving some of that up in order for the greater good. And so therefore, there were rich colonies and poor colonies. There were densely populated colonies and sparsely populated colonies. But whether it was through divine inspiration, human genius, or a combination of the two, we did indeed become the United States. And it's very instructive to look back on this history. We, in school, we really have very, very whitewashed perspective of history. Everything is tied up with a neat little bow, and we really miss reading much of the exciting aspects and the give and the take and the argument that has always been history. But what happened when we did come together? We very quickly, the United States became something much more than the sum total of its parts. And so in this day, this is where we're being challenged. We now have, as an adolescent species, spiritually and socially speaking, we have the resources, we have the technology, and the ability to feed, clothe, house, provide proper medical care, and education to every man, woman, and child on this planet. There are scientists who have even crunched the numbers and told how many billions of dollars it would take, but it's amazing. It's not nearly what we're spending on defense. It would be possible to do that.
And in fact, I just want to interject here. When I was at the World Congress on Sustainable Development back in, this was 2002, I think, the economists working with the military defense budgets this was a United Nations meeting, were saying that if 10%, I think it was 10%, maybe even 1%, but let's say 10% of the top 10 military budgets in the world, of the countries that spend on their military budgets, if only 10% was taken from those military budgets of the 10 countries, we could do what you just said. We could eliminate poverty in the entire world.
Wow, exactly. Well, point very well proven, very well proven on that. So what is it then? Then we must then begin to look at the barriers and also to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what role do we play in this process, if any? Are we individuals? Are we just helpless pawns in this great onrushing current of history and events and decisions made by rulers and presidents? Or do we have a role to play in forging the ever advancement of civilization itself? That's the question that interests me.
I think you're going to say yes, we do have a role to play. And I want to also say, though, if I am just a normal, you know, Jane Smith, living my life here, going to work, trying to take care of my kids and feed my family with my job, and I have my own issues and challenges, how can I be significant in this greater theater that you're painting for us?
Yes. Well, in one word, I would say that education. But that's a very broad word. And it's interesting. In Arabic, there are at least two different words for knowledge. There is ilm, I-L-M, which means acquired knowledge, such as one gains when in school or other types of education. And then there is irfan, which means divine knowledge, which one attains through prayer, reflection, meditation, and the constant focus on trying to improve one's individual character. And it has been said in the Baha'i teachings that humanity, the individual human being, without education, they become even more severe than the beasts of the wild, because an animal itself would never kill another animal unless it was needing to provide itself with food, or was needing to protect its young or its pride or its collective, if you will. Yet human beings, unrefined by education, can sink to all kinds of levels of depravity, and through neglect can even become more darker and damaged individuals. So the role of education is critical. But we must also ask, what does that mean? We can't just, how do I set out upon a path of education?
Exactly.
And when we look at that, then there is the need to know oneself, and then to determine what one's role is at this time.
So, in other words, you're asking me as Jane Smith, to, you know, an example of society, to know myself and my divine education, and to be directed by that guidance going forward?
Yes, exactly. But what does that look like? And so we live in a very confusing time. First of all, we live in a time that if we are to listen to the news networks before us, we would be convinced that we are living in absolutely the most horrible, bellicose period that humanity has ever witnessed. But if we simply examine dispassionately the record of human history, we will see that the century just passed is the century that those statements can be made truthfully about. When we look at the wars that have occurred only in the 20th century alone, forget about the wars, the great wars in other countries that occurred prior to the 20th century and the United States as well that occurred prior to the 20th century, we would be very, very hard-pressed. It's inconceivable to think about this current world being in the state of war and distress that we were in the early part of the 20th century. There are all types of indices, none of which I have hard figures on right now, but I would say, for instance, no matter which direction one looks, the elimination of abject poverty in the world, is it a 30 or 40 year low? The infant mortality rate is at an all-time low. Never in the world have there been more countries collaborating with other countries to seek answers to common problems that impact all people. Never have there been greater examples of international collaboration. Never have human beings traveled more extensively around the globe as they do now. So we really, truly are in a new age. However, this technology allows us, whereas 50 years ago, 100 years ago, if some despot had slaughtered 1,000 of his people, the world might not know about it for years. Now, a particular ruler, a particular leader, or even an individual, some deranged individual can come and do something and perhaps kill a single person in a particularly bloody way, or maybe kill four or five people and the entire world knows about it. Within a matter of minutes, this information spans the world, certainly within a matter of hours. And so yes, we must take that into account. But when I speak of education, part of the education process is to take what we are learning and to search to determine how that applies to where we are and how that applies to my life. And so one piece of advice I would have is that we should not consider our sole education watching the news or reading our favorite websites, or for that matter, the very, very dangerous practice of obtaining our news only through our social media. Because as you know, these social media companies utilize algorithms to basically send the listener or the reader information that supports the type of information that has already been trafficking on their particular site, and sends away any type of information that might contradict what they think, what the reader might think is their current position. And of course, that is done due to a competitive business model. The individuals, the companies that own these social media networks, they obtain revenue through advertisements. And those advertisements, the effectiveness of those advertisements are measured. And they're measured by how sticky something is. And that means how long do you stay on it. So these social media outlets do not wish to do anything that might make me read something that ruffled my feathers and jump off my website, so jump off my social media platform. So I'm no longer being challenged because I was no longer being looking at advertisements. So if we are only getting our media, if we're only getting our news and information from cable news or nightly news or our websites and social media of choice, we are poorly educating ourselves.
So I want to go back to one thing and then explore, you know, like what you might suggest of where we do get our news. But you were mentioning that the 20th century was really the bloodiest century in human history that we know of. In other words, obviously with the world wars, genocides, all kinds of wars around the planet. But then also now that from those that bloody century has come collaborations and willingness of humanity to start to work together. Is that correct?
Yes, quite.
Okay.
Quite.
And then obviously, as you had just said, we now know because of the internet, because of TV and radio, we have such access to information, which we did not in the time of the mid-1900s of, you know, it was only newspaper and radio, and you didn't have this global instantaneous news that could be usurped by any party that chooses to do so.
Exactly. Of course, any time there is will and power, there are ways to prevent the citizenry from obtaining truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes higher and higher forms of that as we move forward. And I believe that much of that today has to do with distraction as well.
Exactly.
But
part of the truth going forward, well, part of the, I just want to point out, and then we'll, I apologize, but, you know, conversation here. I just realized that part of the truth really going forward is there is peace happening on the planet. There are good things happening on the planet. We just don't hear about it in the media and the news, or people choose to not post it on their social media platforms as much as perhaps the negative things happening. So it's about really concentrating on where can we start to create the community? Where are the good deeds being done? How can I be of service? How can I move forward in my own world, my own community, my neighborhood, my family, to make a better life and to, getting back to our topic of us versus them, start to heal that old paradigm of us versus them and go back to the oneness that we truly are.
And I would like to address that. I couldn't agree more. And I would like to look at that through two lenses. Which I believe are two of the ways in which human beings today more frequently than not view themselves as different, view the us and the them. One of them being that of religion. And, of course, religion has, we know oftentimes, religion is not only seen as something that has enabled groups of people to advance, but there are also things that have been done in the name of religion that is not true religion. And so, but I, once again, I believe if we look dispassionately at the history of religion, we can clearly see that the coming of these great dispensations, if you will, these great religious orders that have occurred, these great religions that have been given to humanity by God, have been the source of incredible enlightenment in the world. They have enabled people to sacrifice their individual well-being in healthy ways, and to dare greatly, and to foster civilization. And of course, as a Baha'i, from a Baha'i perspective, we actually have a definition for this. We call it progressive revelation. And I grew up, for instance, in the church. I grew up identifying as a Christian, but I had always been challenged with the idea, as soon as I began to learn that there were other religions, I'm like, well, my minister is telling me that we're the only ones going to heaven and everyone else is going to hell. But yet I began to know people of different religions who were living good lives. And even as a young person, that did not match with my understanding of what God was and what Jesus taught. And then when we look at such truths as the fact that the golden rule runs throughout all revealed religions. I mean, look it up. There is a version of the golden rule running throughout all the major religions. But it would seem that the main reason that we as individuals or as societies actually have created the us or them in our minds about religion is due to the twofold nature of education within religion. If one looks at the doctrines that each of these divine prophets sent, there's obviously many ways to examine them and to study them. But one way is to notice that they each brought social teachings and spiritual teachings. Now, why is that important? It is important because if you look just at the spiritual teachings, you will see that all of the religions are in harmony, that each succeeding religion builds upon the spiritual teachings of the previous ones and continue to unfold this same unarguable perspective about human beings and the nature of the spirit and our responsibility to our brothers and sisters on this planet. However, if one looks at the social teachings that prophet brought, we'll see extreme divergences, that the social teachings that any subsequent prophet brought were oftentimes radically different and opposed to those that a previous prophet brought. For instance, living here in the southeastern United States, it's often very easy to use Christianity as an example, although there are large, rich history of the Jewish community in the South, and there's a wonderful history of Muslims and other religious communities in the South and throughout the United States. But that these social teachings, Jesus, for instance, taught to turn the other cheek, rather that you've heard in times of old, an eye for an eye, I tell you to turn another cheek. And so So Jesus, in this social teaching, was challenging humanity to move beyond the more primitive ways of just simply, okay, if someone threatens you, go ahead and threaten them back. Go ahead and eye for an eye. So you can see the gradual elevation of the collective spirituality of the species, of human beings, as we proceed through this, through these subsequent teachers. However, because of either want of power or want of knowledge, what we are taught many times is divisive. When really, if we read only what the prophets themselves have taught during their times on earth, we will find a much, much more inclusive perspective. The other aspect of that we find very divisive in this age and for many, many, many centuries, but particularly the 20th century and beyond, is that of race. And more particularly in the United States, that between the African-American community and the white community. So racism, institutionalized racism in this country, is another aspect, another phenomenon that is keeping us apart.
And the same with class systems all over the world as well, correct?
Yes, exactly. And there is something that I do want to say more regarding this issue of race. Once again, when we think about the teachings, we will find that there is absolutely nothing in any of the religious teachings throughout history, nor science, none of it can countenance the racism that still exists in this country and in the world. And in our teachings, in the Baha'i teachings, there are some very specific guidance to individuals, both black and white, as it relates to how to move forward with this very sensitive, this very entrenched issue of racism. And the guidance to white people that is given, your people of European descent, that is given in our teachings, is that we must search our hearts for any sense of perhaps even subconscious sense of superiority, which is really fed to us in our mother's milk and through society. I mean, through the mother's milk of society, if you will. Society itself, there's this underlying lie that somehow people of European descent are superior to people of African descent. And it is it's often an unspoken lie. And so that people of European descent in the United States, white people in the United States, need to search their hearts and really purge themselves of this false sense of superiority. And then they must master their patience as they try to move forward in fellowship with people of other races, particularly black people, people of African American race here in the United States. And then the guidance also continues that African Americans, on the other hand, should strive to search their hearts for a false sense, any false sense lingering there of suspicion for white people. Now, I've always found that to be, that when I look at it objectively, the tougher of the two challenges, because where there is nothing that could suggest the true scientific superiority of white people, my black friends encounter frequently evidence that would cause one to need to protect themselves and to maybe be suspicious of a situation. But as we move forward, many of us, even in Atlanta, for instance, whether I grew up in a small town, but then I lived in Atlanta, and even in Atlanta, we know with the exception of just very few urban enclaves throughout Atlanta and throughout the country, we are still incredibly physically segregated. And so that gets us down to back to the role of the individual. If I don't know anyone that's a different color than me, that practices a different religion than me, that thinks some in other ways different than me, but particularly the issue of race and religion. If I don't know anyone like that, if I don't have a single friend who I might not call I call them my 3 a.m. friend. If I was in trouble at 3 o'clock in the morning, I have a very small handful of people that I could call. If I have no friends of a different race or different religion, then how am I really going to gain the necessary insights? And not only the necessary insights, but the enrichment that comes from knowing people that are different than me. Once again, when we go back to the hunter-gatherer society, this is not an unfamiliar tribe that's coming up upon my campfire that I need to decide whether or not I need to defend or not. This is my brother, essentially.
So, Bart, let me stop you here for a moment. We're getting toward the end of the show, but I want to recap. You're basically saying that as a citizen of whatever country we belong in, and as particularly as a citizen of the world, that even in our daily lives, our going to work, our being in our communities, our neighborhoods, our families, we are to really strive to make a friend of what's called the other, of someone different from us, of someone from another religion, someone from another skin color, another ethnicity, and really get to know them, really have them as a true friend, so that the other tends to fall away and we can create a more united world. And I'll give you, you have about maybe 3 or 4 minutes to impart your words of wisdom to our listeners, and then we need to go into the Peace Brain meditation. So
thank you. Thank you, Gail. I've enjoyed this. Thank you, Gail, so much.
Me too. Keep going, though.
So it takes us back down to what can I do as an individual? Where can I actually have impact? And ultimately, certainly there are amazing advocacy groups throughout the country and throughout the world, and I honor all of the work that people are doing in whatever forms of advocacy they do. This is important work, and it's a whole other level of education. But for people like me, the average Joe out there, I believe that some of my most impactful work can be done at the level of neighborhood and community. And so what does that look like? Okay, if I fall into that category where I don't have, if I'm white and I don't have a black friend, or if I'm black and I don't have a white friend, I probably have a black coworker, or I probably have a white coworker. So let us just begin with a conversation, with a coffee. Let us just move out of our realm of comfort. Look at the workplace. The workplace may be integrated, but at the same time, when the work bell rings, once again, we go to our respective neighborhoods. I invite you, I invite the listeners to take an assessment of the individuals that are within their greater community and look for an opportunity to establish new friendships and then, or acquaintanceships, and then assess those acquaintanceships for the opportunities to possibly even break bread together and maybe establish new friendships. And then as we in our neighborhoods, we become very fenced off in our neighborhoods, especially in our Eurocentric neighborhoods. We become very fenced off. If we can begin then to come together and to break bread together, then we can begin to know one another. If we can begin to know one another, then we can begin to know a little bit more about one another's hearts. And then we can begin to know how to assist one another. Because ultimately, what is it? Am I just to live out 80 or 90 or 100 years of this life just seeing how many toys I can end up with? No, I believe that human beings have been created to learn how to serve one another, to be servants to one another, to not just look towards our own selves. We live in a society right now where individualism and materialism have broken all the banks, and we must bring this back into check. And as more and more individuals in their neighborhoods begin to find ways to be of service in their neighborhoods and among their new friends, then I believe that creates a different dynamic within the community. And the individual members of that community are not atomized as they are right now, but they actually, these drops of water actually begin to come together to return to its natural state of oneness. And if we see anyone out there today, because this is a very polarized time, I would like to remind you of a quote that you may very well know from Longfellow. And I don't believe we should see individuals as enemies, regardless of how they're behaving. I think we should see them as human beings. However, Longfellow said this about our enemies. He said, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find enough sorrow and suffering to disarm all hostility. And so I like to take that quote down to where we are, because I don't really have any enemies. So I like to replace that with the people I don't agree with, or the people who I think are
right
off target with whatever their perspectives are, be it political or whatever. If we could read their secret histories, anyone who rubs you the wrong way, if you could read their secret history, you would find enough sorrow and suffering to disarm all hostility. It's easy to love lovable people. Isn't it easy to love lovable people? Don't you love
yes.
to love lovable people? I challenge you that our capacity to love is only tested and therefore strengthened when we encounter people who are harder to love. And so that would be my loving challenge to the listener today, to not eschew the unlovable people in our lives, to recognize that they have a story that we can never know, but to proactively go out there to seek to help lift up someone in their community. And that begins with conversation.
Thank you, Bart. Very wise words, great prescription for going forward. And thank you. I really want to thank you for being on the Peace Brain Show, and I want to let listeners know where to find you if they want to have a longer conversation. And certainly we'll have to do another radio show, I think, on all of this because there's so much more to talk about. But everyone, you can find Bart Shull at bart.shull, that's B-A-R-T, dot S-H-U-L-L, at gmail.com. And then also, I think I'll go ahead and say, if you want to learn more about the Baha'i Faith, you can go to Baha'i.org, that's B-A-H-A-I.org. So thank you again, Bart, for being on the Peace Brain Show.
It's been my pleasure, Gail. Thank you.
All right, so everyone just take a breath and take in what you've heard today. I really appreciate this message here today. And close your eyes for a moment and give yourself a moment to think about who you might know, who might be in your circle of friends or colleagues that you don't know so well, but would be an opportunity to stretch yourself, out of your comfort zone, out of the normalcy of that cadre of friends that is your closest ones you know, and add to your circle someone new, someone who perhaps you can say hello at the coffee table at work, or invite out to a game of tennis, or to go see a movie, or just have a conversation. Who in your community can you begin to be curious about their lives that perhaps are very similar to yours, but they happen to have a different ethnicity, a different religion, a different perspective on life? So take a breath and be in your heart space, that place where little babies and puppy dogs exist. When you hold the baby in your arms or the puppy dog in your arms, that love that you begin to feel. And bring that feeling of love not only to yourself and to your life, but also send it out to that friend, that new prospective friend, just as an energy connection, that you can begin to lay the foundations and the groundwork and the courage within yourself to go say hello, to say, hey, I'd like to know more about you. So take a breath. Give yourself that beautiful love and that courage and that strength. And know that you are of service in the world, and this is part of who you are, to be of service, to create community, to uplift your community. Thank you, and open your eyes, take a breath, go walk in peace in the world, and I want to again thank you for tuning in today to the Peace Brain Show. And remember, if you'd like to connect again with Bart Schull, that's bart.schull@gmail.com. And if you'd like to talk with me more or connect with me, Dr. Gail Lash, you can go to my website, tourismforpeace.com, or email me at hello@peacebrain.org. So again, I want you to go forth and have a beautiful life. Create community and activate your peace brain and put your map on the your mark on the World Peace Trails map. Many, many blessings. Namaste.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.